coronavirus genome consists of single strand of positive sense RNA reponing cartridge. So my question is, if it's so humongous, why is it so difficult to spot it in the patient? And the second thing, I mean, I came to this idea because it resonated. Was it the 120 nanometers comes to 2.4 terahertz. So we go to 2.49, so 2.5 terahertz. So if we go by the scale of prefixes, tera, giga, mega, kilo, hecta, deca, deci, centi, milli, micro, nano, pico, femto, ato, we may say that is next to giga. Next level up to giga is tera. We can resonate it to find out about them, or resonate it to kill them eventually, kill the patient into exist.
AC2GS. Well, Wesley, you sort of mentioned what the down part of that is, killing the patient along with the virus. The problem is that that's not the only thing that's 120 nanometers in the human body. So you're going to get a lot of false positives and you're going to get a lot of confusion. The way that generally science is actually doing it is they're replicating the viral RNA and then doing tests to see whether those amplified RNA molecules are present in the test solution, and that's the positive result. That's sort of the reason why it takes 3 days for the older method, because it has to go through multiple cycles of replicating the RNA from the viral particles that are taken with the swab. So that at least has a decent percentage of accuracy. If you just kind of scan a human body for anything that's 120 nanometers, God knows what you'll pick up. There's all kinds of things that size.
So I need a correction. Doctors use a stick with something on it that they put to your nose inside and eventually collect whatever is in there. And then if you put that on the microscope into two slides, then you'd put all of the bacteria that is there. And because of significantly corona-like shape of that humongous 120 nanometers virus, we would be able to spot it. And that's what I need correction with.
Okay, Wesley, all I can do is try and convince you that in terms of, say, a organic aromatic molecule, because we talked about that last week, that hairspray and such goes right through these things, it's a very large object. In terms of other things, it's a very small object. It's not resolvable with the spikes using any technology of optical microscopy. You have to use an electron microscope in order to make out the characteristic spikes on the protein, on the membrane. So you can't just put it in an optical microscope and look at it. You would see bacteria and epithelial cells and mucosal cells and just dirt, and you wouldn't know whether those teeny tiny itsy bitsy little spots are just dirt or they're coronaviruses.
Okay. The range of optical microscope 500 times. Maybe a little bit more than that. I'm trying to find out. I didn't convert that to nanometers yet. How far? The electron microscope, yeah, starting from 200 nanometers, which is quite nice range for it. What is the maximum range of the optical microscope?
Offhand, I don't know. You got to realize that you have to play games to get those high magnifications. You have to use oil immersion lenses and other things. But I have never, ever, ever heard that anyone ever saw any details of a virus using any microscope that I know of. If it was as simple as that, I assure you the guys at the CDC who have lots of expensive microscopes would be doing that. But based upon my understanding and the microscope that I bought in medical school, you ain't going to see viruses.
In the meantime, while we were talking, I was able to find it 450 microns. So 450 microns edge, the size of 120, that would be 1/4. Yeah, well, theoretically, you could spot something like this, but I agree with you. Interesting.
Okay, very good, Wes. So we both agree. That's always good. There was another gentleman, unfortunately, it was before Bill. I wasn't able to write down his call sign, so if you asked to say something about this between Wesley and Bill, please give me your name and your call sign again. Okay, nothing heard. Bill, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, two questions actually. One is if the virus is in, is it a capsid or is it a lipid envelope? Is that common to viruses in general? Or most viruses sort of naked without some kind of encapsulation? The other thing is about statistics and numbers. I'm looking at what I think is a really good site at worldometers.info/coronavirus. It gives global numbers, and then you can drill into the United States, and you can see what's going on in the past day in each state and union. That's really good. It'll give you graphs for each.
Yeah, I have it up on my screen, and it's listed on my link page, roy.ac2gs. It's .com. It's a very useful site. There's a few of them out there. And to answer your question, viruses have an outer coating. Viroids are just raw RNA or DNA particles. They're much more primitive, less successful infectious objects, but they do infect the cells. But the coating usually is a lipid coating because it basically steals the cell's lipid coating, and then it adds specific protein spikes on the outside, which effectively interact with receptors on the cell's the outer cell of mucous membrane, and that's what kind of induces the cell to take it into the cell body and causes the infection to start going.
Okay, when I lifted my key, you were talking already. So I take it from what you said that lipid shell is not universal among viruses, but it's very common, I guess, at least among successful ones that infect people. The second question was about statistics and where people are getting their best information. I'm getting information from worldometers.info/coronavirus. It's got graphs per country, as well as some kind of daily breakdowns of infections by state within the United States, but I'm not able to find anything that breaks down the information, more granular way than by state. So I do not have a way to check progress and see what's going on in New York City, which I think would be very interesting. Does anyone have a way to get that more granular data to CGIS.
Okay, Bill, what I said, I guess we doubled, is that I'm familiar with Worldometer, and I have it as one of my linked pages that people can take a look at. And as you mentioned, it is not quite as granular as you and I would like it to be. I got my additional information from the New York Times. Part of what I was going to talk about, if I had time, was that today's death rate in New York City is actually a little bit less. It's gone down from 630 yesterday to 590-something, and hopefully this isn't a statistical little quirk. But if anyone has the sight of a more granular breakdown of the United States viral statistics, please share with us.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
I've been using something called livescience.com/coronavirus. And, you know, they give you everything. And then, you know, you'll see all the different states. And then you can click on New York State, and they'll give you the breakdown, all the boroughs, and Suffolk County, upstate, you know, different counties. And that's about it. It doesn't go down to the town level, but it will give you the different boroughs, if that's what he's looking for. I see on the boroughs that they'll just give you cases. They won't give you the death rate. Back to you, Rory.
Okay, I'm on that site. Let me see how deeply I can click into it.
Echo link question.
Okay, one sec. I'm down into it. I don't know if it's the same page that you were using. If you could do me a favor and give me a link to that page, email it to me. I'll include it on the link page. So if someone wanted to ask a question on Echo Link.
Yes, this is K7WJN. Am I coming across?
Yes, you are, Bill.
Okay, Doc, thanks for taking my question. I got a question about ultraviolet light, C-band, Charlie, C-band, ultraviolet light. Would that kill the virus? Back to you.
Well, in a word, yes, Bill. You have to expose it for enough energy to be transferred. It depends upon how many watts the UVC is capable of. The only little gotcha with UVC is it kills what it comes in contact with. So if it's, say, a multi-layered mask, as someone mentioned, it may not be as effective because it may get totally absorbed on the surface of the first layer and not really get into the underlying layers. For those types of masks, it probably would be more prudent to use something different. Some hospitals are vaporizing 30 to 35% hydrogen peroxide. Other people, as I've mentioned before, are dousing their stuff in 70% isopropyl alcohol and then letting it dry. But theoretically, UVC will kill on contact virus. People are saying killed and being unhappy with it. So just assume when I say kill, it deactivates it, it makes it non-virulent, it breaks it. Because it's not quite alive.
Okay, Doc, I appreciate your response. Thank you. K7WJN, back to Ned.
Okay, very good. It's coming up to Paul's space report, so I'll just ask if anyone has any general questions about the coronavirus and that I could answer reasonably quickly, so I don't want to impact on full space report. So if anyone has any questions about the virus that haven't been answered yet, feel free.
WA2MHL, question?
Yeah, what's your question?
Why does NMAS just work one way and not the other?
Well, I mean, as far as the N95, they work both ways. If you are infectious and you cough into a N95 that has a filter that filters out the viral particles, you're not going to give it to the next guy. And if the guy next to you coughed on you and you're wearing a well-fitted N95, you're not going to get his virus. So N95s and higher quality masks are two-way. The cloth and paper and plastic are one-way because they don't actually offer a barrier for the viral particles themselves. They're primarily stopping the big droplets. So that's kind of why it's only a one-way type of benefit for the most part. There's a little other way benefit, but it's not something you want to rely upon.
What about getting it through your eyes?
Yes, indeed. You can get it through your eyes, unfortunately. Any mucous membrane, and we have two nostrils, a mouth, and two eyes. The eyes and the material that moves either on the side of your eyelid, the upper and lower eyelid, the mucous membrane. So if someone coughs in your eyes, you get a virus. That is why if you've ever looked at videos of people dressed up for infection control, in addition to sometimes wearing goggles, they also wear a face a shield. So the eye is a sneaky way for it to come, but yeah, you can get it in your eye as well.
Boy, I'm still not understanding it. Even with the paper mask, if they can't stop the droplets from coming in, why do they stop the droplets from going out?
Because before they hit the ground, there will be some evaporative changes that will that might make them smaller, so that you have to deal with other problems. Again, that's not that much of a problem, but it's enough that you shouldn't kind of think that you're Superman. If someone coughs really close to you, the big droplets will get stopped and absorbed by the cloth, paper, plastic, but they'll be saturated, and then the liquid will just kind of ooze out the other end, and you're in trouble. That's Wesley.
Somebody asked if he can use a paper mask again, and you're saying the paper mask really only helped, you know, in terms of not infecting somebody else. But what gets used up in a paper mask? And would two paper masks be better than one?
I guess theoretically two would be a little bit better than one. The problem with paper masks that we were talking about is it's incredibly more difficult to actually clean them. Once you've contaminated them, you generally don't want to wear a contaminated mask, so you want to clean it with cloth and with plastic. There are multiple ways that you could cycle it repeatedly. Paper takes a lot more punishment trying to sterilize it than cloth and plastic.
Okay, contaminated them with what? With your own mucus? How do they get contaminated if you wear them once? How do they get contaminated to make them not usable twice?
Well, I mean, primarily, these are theoretically, for the most part, protections for the other person on the other side. If you now are walking around with a piece of fabric that is doused in your viral particles and you continue to cough and sneeze through that mask, it's going to be significantly less effective. So you sort of want not necessarily a sterile mask, but at least a non-contaminated mask if you're going to really protect people on the other side.
Got it. Thanks, Roy. Back to you.
Welcome. We'll turn to Wesley for the last comment, question, what have you, before the space report. So, Wesley, your turn.
Yeah, two things, actually. Considering the size of the virus, your mask is absolutely, seems absolutely to be open space. Like we have a helium particle where we have a high vacuum, and we're not able to keep the vacuum. It's always going to be lowering itself because the spaces between the molecules, or the spaces between the grains of the metal, or spaces between the atoms in the given material that supposed to be holding the vacuum inside the tube are bigger than the size of the particle. So the electron cloud is actually a huge open space for an electron around an atom. By that, wearing the mask and not wearing a mask for the virus doesn't make much difference, but because virus is inside a droplet and droplet has a certain size, sneezing from inside by when wearing the mask may prevent the droplets to go out, or prevent the spread. And it is not 6 feet, it's 6 meters. So 6 times 3, you have 10 feet, 3 feet in meter. So that was one part of the sentence. The other one is, if the force that is immune from the virus, because they already healthy, they have been affected to the virus, now they healthy, they could work instead of the whole city not working. What do you think about it?
Now, Wesley, getting back to the mask for a second, it's 2 meters or 6 feet is what most of the people are telling everyone. But you have it right. As I said, it's a one-way protection from you infecting someone else. And one of the stories today was going to be, maybe next week it will be, about a test, a serology test, to see if people have built up immunity and have developed antibodies to the virus. Down the road, this has been approved, and people will be tested, and people who show a immunity to the virus will hopefully be able to go back and do things without fear of either getting themselves infected or giving it to anyone else. So that's a long-range plan, I believe, that the CDC and HHS have for the future. So that's going to happen.
Thank you very much.
Welcome. I just want to answer someone on EchoLink left a text message, KC2WMT, about an ozone machine. Ozone machine also would effectively kill the virus. You have to make sure that you're using material, whatever the mask is made of, that doesn't degrade in that concentration of ozone. Because it can be a rather noxious, it's an oxidizing free radical oxygen that does the trick. So if it's using a material that's stable in the concentration of ozone, Ozone is a perfectly good choice for decontaminating a mask. Anyway, let me turn this over to Paul for the space report. I just want to remind people that if they have any topics or mailbag questions or puzzles or what have you for me, or if they want me to pass it on to Paul, any website or topic for discussion, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And the link page will be loaded up with a couple of entries tonight. And in an hour or so, you can go to roy.ac2gs.com and take a look at the links. I want to thank everyone who participated tonight, as always. It's you guys that make the net what it is. And otherwise, I'd just be talking to myself. So let me pass it off to Paul, WS2N, for the space report.
AC2GS, WS2N. Very good, Roy. By the way, I sent you that link regarding the different states where you can zoom in more or less on the on different counties. You know, you can get Putnam County, you know, all the counties in New York. The virus has got the space program slowed down quite a bit, of course, like all industries. They are. Considered urgent and essential. So some of the projects are still going. I don't know how Elon Musk is getting away with it. His project that he's got going down in Boca Chica, Texas, is still going. It's called the Starship. And he keeps building different Starships as he tests them, and they tend to blow the tanks from overpressurizing them. He's gone through, two, and now this is the third one. A couple of days ago, he got a failure on the third Starship. The Starship is around 220 feet tall without the cone on top. The top part would be where you would have all your passengers and people that would go off to the moon or Mars. It's roughly 200 feet tall, around 27 feet in diameter. And he's got some tanks that he wants to fill them up with, eventually with liquid methane, liquid oxygen, dropping. But to get to that point, he keeps testing with liquid nitrogen, which is, of course, is inert, and he doesn't have to worry about fire. But, you know, it's cryogenically cooled. And he keeps filling them up, and a couple months ago, the top dome of the tank blew off. It's all stainless steel, 532 steel. That's how thick it is, 5/32 of an inch. So it's pretty thick. It's got them all helioc welded or TIG welded, and I'm sure there's a lot of arc welding with there. With 318, the rod that they would use for this all this welding that's going on, because it's all welded in big, huge pieces, and it creates this massive tank. So the first one blew up a couple of months ago. The second one blew up last month. It was overpressured. It really didn't blow up, but it essentially collapsed. And then he builds a new one. So this third one he built standing on the platform. He's got legs. He's installing legs. He's going to have six legs. This thing eventually will take off and come down and land vertically. So he fills it up again with liquid nitrogen. And sure enough, he got to a certain pressure. I think it was around 6 to 8 bar, or, each bar is 14.7 pounds per square inch, so he gets up to like 100 some odd pounds. This time it was okay, and then he started draining it, and he hasn't come up with an answer yet what happened, but the whole side of it collapsed and then the whole top came down and crashed down to the onto the launch pad. But I saw the video and it looked like, you know, like you would take a big can and create a vacuum on the inside and it would collapse. That's what it looked like. So maybe they were draining this liquid nitrogen. Maybe they did it too fast or created a vacuum. And that's what it looks like. But I haven't heard a final reason for it. He's got to correct that. He's already building the fourth iteration of this to try to test again. This is all down in Boca Chica, Texas. They've got crews down there working. They don't seem to care about the virus. I haven't heard any comments that anybody's taking any precautions, but it's pretty much outdoor work. I guess they feel they're okay. If he completes this, he's got three Raptor engines. He's built his own liquid methane, liquid oxygen engine. He's actually flown one of them before. Flown the engine on a test vehicle last year. But he wants to take three of these things. And each one produces, you know, over 400,000 pounds of thrust. So he wants to fly this thing about 150 meters into the air. So, you know, 500-600 feet into the air and bring it down vertically and land it. That's his goal. He thought he would have had it done by now, but he keeps blowing up these starships. I would say next month he should be ready again to try. And if he gets the 500-foot flight, and after that he'll try for, he's going to shoot up for 20 kilometers, you know, like 12 miles. And again, bring the Starship back down and land on the launch pad, or right near the launch pad. So that's his goal. Once that's all complete, it might take the next 6 months, maybe a year. He plans on eventually putting six of these engines inside the Starship and trying to get this into orbit. Everything I'm describing to is actually the second stage of this whole vehicle. He's got the first stage he hasn't even started yet, and that's going to be much bigger rocket. Instead of having three engines to launch this vehicle into space, it'll have 31 engines, 31 of these Raptor engines. Again, liquid methane, liquid oxygen. And the Starship that we've been talking about would be put on top of that. So, you know, you're looking at something that's, I think they said around 363 feet high, almost as high as the Saturn V rocket that went to the moon. So, again, with this almost 30-foot diameter vehicle from the bottom all the way up. So that's his goal. For some reason, he's able to work through this through the virus down in Texas. So let me drop it. See if there's any comments or questions about Elon Musk and SpaceX Starship. This is WS. Okay, nothing hard. Another mission I've been following that really has been shut down is the 2020 Mars rover. Now, it has a name called Perseverance. Perseverance will be launched on July 17th of this year. The coronavirus has not stopped the production or testing of this vehicle. So they still think right now, as of right now, should be able to get off the pad on time. If there's delays due to the virus and they're unable to make that launch window in July, they would have to wait a little over 2 years for another launch. And that's due to the orbital mechanics between Mars and Earth. Earth goes around once, Earth goes around twice, Mars goes around once. And figure that out as you look around. You know, Earth will go all the way around. When Earth goes all the way around the sun one full time, Mars will only get halfway around. So the second year when Earth goes all the way around the Sun, Mars will continue on and wind up back where it started from, and that would be 2 years. It's actually around 26 months. So that will be a shame to delay that mission. It's planned to launch on an Atlas V rocket from Launch Complex 41 in Florida. It's got four solid booster rockets attached to it, and Atlas V is very powerful rocket. It had like 80 different launches over the years, so it's very successful. I believe Boeing says it's a 100% launch record. Boeing and Lockheed collaborate on that rocket. So hopefully it'll go. Now, the reason I bring it up is the engineers are still working on it down in Florida, and they just, getting it ready to fly in Florida. But they put the wheels on, the six wheels. These wheels are around 22 inches in diameter. They're aluminum. They've been formed out of a solid block of aluminum. So it's must be some operation to do that. But it's very thin. It's relatively very thin. It is a little thicker than the wheels that were on Curiosity. It's still riding around on Mars. And it also has different treads on it. The treads on the old one, they didn't like that much. This one's a little bit better. The wheel is a little bit narrower than Curiosity. It's again a little bit bigger in diameter. And they've done numerous tests with it because it's a millimeter thicker than the older wheels. They feel that going to make all the difference. Right now, Curiosity, as it rides around Mars, has developed a lot of holes in the wheels, in the six wheels. Sharp rocks tend to penetrate the wheels. So due to that problem, when they plan a route, let's say they want to go 300 feet one way, they'll pick sometimes the longer way to do it to avoid certain rocks. They look ahead. Got mast cams and navigation cams, and they've got 17 different cameras on Curiosity. They manage to avoid that when they notice all the holes in the wheels. Some years ago, that thing's been riding around since 2012. So it's been on Mars a long time. It's not solar powered. It's got a radioisotope thermal electric generator, so it's got plutonium heating up graphite blanket there. Hundreds of these pieces of metal which are generating electricity. They have them set up series parallel. I think it's probably 1,000 different thermocouples, and that's how they power the rover. And Perseverance is going to be powered the same way. So hopefully it'll get off the ground. I think I mentioned last week that they put a plaque on the top of Perseverance. They've got this support bracket, aluminum bracket that goes from one side, left side to right side of the rover. And on top of that support bracket, they put this plaque, and in the plaque they have three little tiny chips as big as your fingernail. And on the chips, they have over 10 million names of people that were sent have sent their names to NASA last year to land on Mars. And one of the names is mine. And so I'm hoping that this thing gets to Mars in February of 20, It'll be February of 21. This coming February, actually, will be when it lands on Mars. And that's the story about Perseverance, the update on that. And let's see if there's any comments or questions. This is WS2F. Okay, another project that hasn't been stopped by the coronavirus is BepiColombo. Colombo. It's a European Space Agency mission. BepiColombo Colombo is a spacecraft that was launched a year and a half ago that is on its way to orbit Mercury. European Space Agency launched it with another satellite attached to it by the Japan. Japan has so it's two vehicles that'll be both going to be orbiting Mercury eventually back in, let's see, I think around 2025. It's going to take that many years to get there. The Japanese mission is called Mercury Planetary Orbiter. Bepi Colombo goes in much closer to orbit around Mercury. So they're going to work together. They've got a deal between Japan and the European Space Agency. But to get there, they have all these different gravity assists. And the first one is coming up this April 10th. And the gravity assist is Earth. So what happens is it gets launches, you know, ahead of the Earth's orbit as we go around the sun, and eventually it goes around and comes back and meets up again with Earth. And when it does, it picks up the gravity assist and it gets swung further into the center of the solar system toward Mercury. And eventually it'll do a couple of loops around the sun, and it's going to have a gravity assist, two of them with Venus. And again, that will steer it close to destination of orbiting Mercury. But to do this, because of the coronavirus, they wanted to shut down mission control in Germany. You know, a lot of these missions that are run from European Space Agency come out of their mission control is Darmstadt, Germany. You know, we have our mission control, which is of course Houston. If SpaceX is doing a mission, they have their mission control out of Portland, California. Hubble is controlled from Maryland, and Darmstadt, Germany, of course, was infected by the virus. And they found one guy involved with this group that goes into this mission control that had the virus. And that was about 3 or 4 weeks ago. So what they did is they took him away. But everybody in the building went into quarantine. All these people that operate these science missions. And they checked them out. Over 2 weeks later, and they got the okay, so they're going to be able to stay in the building, which is good because they shut down four main scientific missions. One we talked about on net quite a bit, called the Solar Probe. They just launched just recently, a couple of months ago. It's on the way to the sun, and well, that was shut down. Some of the science missions orbiting Mars were shut down. But now that could all be brought back to life. What wasn't shut down was this Bepi Colombo Mercury mission. And the reason for that is because you can't stop this thing from coming close to Earth. So they want to keep an eye on that. And also they have some thing that they want to do. They want to calibrate a lot of different instruments on board Bepi Colombo, make sure everything's coming into Mercury, so that, you know, they left a small staff there to do that, but now they can be joined by the other people and get their other science missions back up and running. So that's the story with the European Space Agency. like I said, some projects are still ongoing, and that's one of them, as well as the Kepler Propulsion Laboratory Perseverance rover ready to go to Mars. Let me drop it for any comments. This is WS2M. Okay, here's another mission. I know Roy would remember this when we talked about the Israeli Bereshit spacecraft that was supposed to land on the moon last year. And they did good. They got real close, you know, a couple kilometers away. You know, after going through this whole process, you know, they launched on the top of a Falcon 9 rocket from SpaceX. They had the spacecraft attached to the top of a big Indonesian communication satellite that was scheduled to go to a geosynchronous orbit. But on top of that was a Bereshit spacecraft that was scheduled to go to the moon. It got into orbit around the moon, doing very well. And then it came time to try to land. They had these pulsing rocket engines. Apparently, they had some wrong code, computer code that was put into it, and misunderstood what it was supposed to do. And I think the spacecraft flipped 180 degrees. The engine was firing. And to make a long story short, hit the moon at like 500 miles per hour. So this company in Israel, naturally, he's very disappointed, but they had a whole hundreds of millions of dollars, whatever, was put into this. They don't want to put any more into it. They're trying it again. So along comes an American company called Firefly. And Firefly got a hold of this company, and they said, you know, you almost made it. How about, you know, partnering up with Firefly and see if we can do this again. And which they agreed to. So now this Bereshit mission is going to be like something on like their spacecraft on steroids. And they're going to call it Genesis. So it's a bit of Genesis mission, but it's the descendant of the Israeli Bereshit mission. So I'm sure they're going to be thrilled over there if they're able to get this thing land in 2022. Firefly is building their own rockets. They have a launch complex in California, Vandenberg Air Force Base, that they're working on building. They haven't launched a rocket yet, but their Alpha rocket is under construction. And they have a deal with Aerojet Rocketdyne to build an engine. They actually have an engine that's really complete. It's called the AR-1. AR-1 is a powerful engine. I mean, it's going to be like almost 500,000 pound thrust, which is pretty massive. And they plan on just putting one of those engines in the bottom of a Firefly rocket. And on top of that, they eventually plan on launching payloads to orbit or eventually to the moon. But that won't be ready in time. They need to launch the new Genesis mission sooner than that. And it looks like they're making a deal with SpaceX to launch on a Falcon 9 rocket. So, it'll be something to look forward to. Any American company that could get to land a vehicle on the moon, with or without people, of course, is great. But I mean, China's up there in the last few years. They've landed a vehicle and a rover on the near side of the moon, and another vehicle and a rover on the far side of the moon, and enough is enough. We need to get an American company or NASA or somebody to do the same thing. So. So that's something I'll be looking forward to. Cover sheet on steroids called Genesis by a company called Firefly with Reaver engines. I don't know if anybody ever saw the, was a series on TV called Firefly, so apparently they've taken that name and named it after certain groups of people that were in that movie, Reaver, for the Reaver engines. Any comments or questions? This is WSYX. Okay, the company I've talked about is Stratolaunch. Stratolaunch was this vehicle, it was an airplane, massive airplane. It's the longest wingspan ever made. It's over the length of a football field. That's how it's over 300 feet long.
Junk it, there was no talk of what was going to happen with this
missing after Paul Allen died. But sure enough, they came up with this. So I found that interesting. Probably even many years from now, I'll be talking about black ice. An automobile that would be capable of bringing cargo to any space station. So, and someday they have long-term plans of being able to actually transport a crew on this thing. Let me drop. This is WS2N for any comments? Okay, a couple of other things I wanted to talk about, but we're going to run out of time, I can see it. But this is Sunrise satellite system, half a dozen satellites that NASA wants to launch. They've got a contract to do that, and it's got a bunch of antennas on board. It's going to have a bunch of radio receivers and be able to receive signals from the sun, and this way they'll get an early warning system on any mass corona ejections that might be coming from the sun, which could eventually damage astronauts or damage satellites in orbit. So that's something on the agenda. Also, NASA has chosen a couple of people for future crews for the Dragon mission. First Dragon mission should go up in May, hopefully. That would just have two people on board, maybe stay a couple of months on station and eventually come back. But that's more or less a test to see if it works. If everything works, they get the okay from NASA, they'll be sending up four people on a regular basis. And they now have those four people, for a crew. So originally it was going to be Mike Hopkins and Vic Grover. We're going to take that mission up, but they needed two more people. And they've chosen Sharon Walker. Sharon Walker's an astronaut. She's been up to the space station back in 2010. And spent, I think, 150, 160 days up there. She's involved with the space program for years, as well as her husband, Andy Thomas. He comes out of Australia, but he's a NASA astronaut. He himself went up to Mir, the original space station that Russia had. Not the original, but the last space station Russia had. So she'll be going up. Sharon Walker with, they got somebody from Japan.
That time was complete.
In the space station. I think it was around the same time that Sharon Walker was up there. So she, Nagachi, he's got plenty of experience. I met him up there many, many years ago, and these people are still astronauts and ready to go. So he'll be from the European Space Agency, not the European, from the Japanese Space Agency, and then we'll have three Americans on that flight. And that'll be a regular flight where four go up there and they just stay there. So when they do that, instead of having a regular crew of six on the space station, it'll be a regular crew of seven, which would really be nice. The amount of science that you're going to get back will double if you have just that one extra person on station. This is WS1 for the SpaceNet report. For the TechNet, let me turn it over to Roy. See if he's got anything to add. We'll be on the Club Info Net tomorrow night at 8 o'clock on these repeaters. Roy, AC2GS, this is WS2N. How you doing?
AC2GS, thank you very much, Paul. Firefly was a great short-lived science fiction television show and a one-off movie called Serenity, I believe. It was enjoyable. Unfortunately, it was cut rather short, like much science fiction is. Anyway, I just want to remind people once again that if you have any technical questions, mailbag type questions, or topics you would like to hear covered, or puzzles, to offer me, or you offices have any information to pull or of a website or a subject to discuss, you can send it at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And I've already posted